Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on America's debt imbalance when we return right after this. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there is no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and clad coin and currency. And that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on that paper money over gold and silver money. Now, you know, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew, and they knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away their gold and silver coin in order to take away the people's right to property and to destroy their property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, especially our property rights, then we must first regain our property and property rights through gold and silver coin. And that's because property is based. That is, property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now, for more information about private business and our private business school, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. The number, 417-273-4967. Now, my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the privateer. I'll give you the address to get a copy of the privateer. You can actually subscribe to the privateer for 5 sample copies for $25 Australian. I think it's well worth your time, effort, and energy because it's one of the few newsletters that tells you what's really going on in the world of economics worldwide and in the United States. This is not a pablum paper like we see with the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, or the sound bites that we hear on Lou Dobbs or Wall Street Week. These are the numbers that come right out of the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury, the Wall Street banks that tell us where reality is located. It isn't a secret. It's published every day. The information's out there. It's just that nobody is reporting that information to you. Now, the U.S. internal economy is going nowhere. And this is despite the fact that the U.S. federal debt is expanding at 10% annually, and American consumer debt 11% annually, and our U.S. businesses are expending or going into debt at the rate of 4% annually. And these numbers are the internal U.S. credit expansion numbers. The spillover is the U.S. external deficits on current account and trade. These two deficits show that the U.S. external debts are going up, up, and away. The only thing which is currently holding the entire U.S. economic, monetary, and financial edifice up is all of the new money that's rolling in from the rest of the world. Now, once this now slowing inflow of foreign funds goes below the U.S. current account deficit, it's all over. We will go into default. That's what happened in Argentina 2 years ago. Now, the United States Federal Reserve reports that the U.S. consumer debt outstanding grew by a more than expected $10.9 billion in July. The central bank said that credit grew to a seasonally adjusted rate of $2 trillion in July. $2 trillion in July, and $2 trillion in June. And yes, these are trillions, not billions. Now let's take a look at the future by looking at the past. There's an old adage that says that he who is unable or unwilling to learn from the history of the past is bound to repeat it. We Americans are in the process of repeating the same economic mistakes that we made in the 1920s and paid for in the 30s. The same economic mistakes that we saw imposed upon the South American nations in the 1970s, we're doing those very same acts right now today. We did it in the 1990s. We're about to reap the whirlwind or the just desserts that come from these malinvestments. So let's go back to the prehistoric times, to the days before August 15th, 1971, when President Nixon broke the U.S. dollar's connection to gold and turned it into just another piece of paper. Before that date, when a nation, either inadvertently or intentionally, began an internal credit expansion and or an inflation of the quantity of its own nation's currency, and then began increasing its imports, it faced a drain upon its foreign exchange reserves very quickly. That acted to tighten its own internal finance and credit conditions as commercial and then consumer rates of interest started to climb. So if the government of such a nation, acting in ignorance of economics, pressed on with its economic expansion and or monetary inflation, there arrived a point where the rest of the world pulled that country up hard. When that point arrived, the treasurer of the nation could often be seen standing in front of the cameras to announce that the nation's currency had just been devalued. Now, after such a forced devaluation, which is the national form of bankruptcy, after such a forced devaluation, the cost of imported economic goods would then be much higher than before. Imports would then ebb and slow. As seen from the rest of the world, the economic goods of the devalued nation were now much cheaper than before. So exports from the nation increased and its foreign exchange holdings improved as additional amounts of foreign exchange arrived. Then internal monetary conditions eased and the entire economy had been rebalanced between imports and exports, and then its trade would revive. Well, in March of 1973, the floating regime arrived. These global fixed exchange rate currency regimes had broken down by March of 1973, and from that moment forward, all of the currencies of the world have been floating against each other. Since idiots abound in high office in many lands, this floating regime was seen as a heaven-sent opportunity for engaging in credit expansions as well as monetary inflation. If the currency subjected to such heroic treatment fell gradually, but faster than other currencies fell against all real economic goods, that was even seen as being a good thing, because it gave a chance for the export industries to expand. And this whole scenario finally blew up in the late 1970s when the general public finally lost its temper, having had enough of trying to live using a money which constantly lost its value against all other economic goods. And as consumer prices climbed faster and faster worldwide, the public tried to escape this paper money trap and started buying more and more gold. Well, when gold hit $850 an ounce in 1980, the world's paper money systems were in danger of total collapse. So Paul Volcker, who then ran the U.S. Federal Reserve System, saved the day at that time, 1980, by making the simplest of historic statements. He said this, quote, "We have stopped targeting interest rates, and now instead we are targeting money quantity." So Paul Volcker kept a tight grip on the quantity of U.S. dollars by letting U.S. market interest rates go in whatever direction they wanted. So they did. They went up. They went way up. 21%. And against a slowly climbing quantity of U.S. dollars and tight credit conditions, the U.S. economy had one of its most severe recessions ever. So as a large part of the malinvestments created by this previous U.S. credit expansion, they were cleared off the board. Now, sadly to say, that was all a quarter of a century ago. And in the late 1970s, the U.S. economy still had the ability to revive itself. The United States was still the biggest creditor and the greatest manufacturing nation on earth, but that is no longer the case. Now, the United States became an external net debtor, and that began in 1985. The United States manufacturing sector has been savaged, and we can see that from the 2.7 million manufacturing jobs that have been lost over the past 5 years, and they have been exported to China, Japan, Singapore, and the Pacific Rim. Now, when you place all of this beside the huge magnitude of debts now carried by all sectors within the United States, the problem becomes clearer. There is simply no way that the United States could handle internal interest rates even half of the 20% plus interest rates that we saw at the end of the 1970s. But something has to give in this current situation. The sole central item which can lower the current height or extent of the external U.S. debt is a massive fall in the international value of the U.S. dollar. The only item which can lower internal U.S. debt is a combination of public and private debt defaults, accompanied by a lengthy surge in internal U.S. goods prices. Either would push U.S. interest rates up, and not just up, but up, up, and away. Now, inside the United States, there is a plenitude of self-chosen powers. So let's shift our direction now, and let's take a look at the power that's behind the United States government. And a vote of thanks ought to be extended to the renowned American reporter, Mr. Seymour Hersh, for having unearthed this immense grab for personal power by President Bush. And Mr. Hersh reports that a secret document signed by Mr. Bush in February, as February the 7th, 2002 to be exact, here's what it says. President Bush said, quote, "I determine that none of the provisions of the Geneva Convention apply to our conflict with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan or elsewhere throughout the world," unquote. Note especially the words, "I determine." That's President Bush has made this determination. The provisions of the Geneva Convention are, of course, the solemn Geneva Conventions to which the USA has long been a signatory nation, as fully ratified by the U.S. Senate. Now, this creates an enormous constitutional problem, and it creates an enormous geopolitical problem around the world. If the United States can make this kind of a claim, if the chief executive, the president of the United States, can make the claim that I determine, well, isn't that dictatorial power? Isn't that what we're fighting in Iraq, the dictatorial power of a dictator who says I determine? Well, the enormous constitutional problem is this, and the central point of this constitutional problem is that it is not in the hands of any American president to alter, change, or void any treaty which the U.S. Senate, by open vote, has ratified. That so-called power is nowhere to be found in the American Constitution. And the facts are these, that while a proposed treaty is being examined by the Senate, a president can engage in his own efforts to have part or all of it changed, or even have the proposed treaty set aside. But once that treaty has been agreed to by the Senate, then a president's past course of action, or his last course of action, is to veto that treaty. The president does have the veto power. But if the Congress then decides that the treaty is wanted, it can drive the treaty right through the executive power with a two-thirds vote and then force a president to accept it. This is called overriding the president's veto. And once a president signs such a treaty to which the Senate has agreed, by the act of signing it, the treaty becomes the law of the land right across the United States and is binding on every successor president. Now, that being so, and it is so, this law applies to that president, George Bush, and all presidents following for as long as that treaty has standing. Now, for any president to then act counter to the law of the land is the de facto grounds for impeachment, and in no way different from any other official's random personal choice to act counter to standing law. Such acts are unconstitutional. Lower officials who commit them face court. Presidents should face impeachment. Now, the above, then, is the direct sense, as well as legal history, of the American Constitution. But by acting in the manner in which he now has, President Bush has, in fact, set the Constitution aside. If, as President Bush's actions show, he sees this to be in his hands, to choose which parts of the Constitution that he wants to abide by and which parts of the Constitution he wants to set aside, then he is claiming a personal as well as a presidential power which stands above the Constitution itself. In fact, he makes a claim to have an unlimited personal political power as shown by the phrase, "I determine." Now, this is the kind of behavior that we condemned on the part of Saddam Hussein. We condemned it on the part of Adolf Hitler. Shouldn't it be condemned on the part of George Bush? Well, constitutionally, the law is given to him by Congress, which then delegates that power to him as president to give such law a force and effect by the execution of the law. This is called the executive power. This is the president's executive power. Now, in and of itself, there are no lawmaking powers inherent in the presidency. There is an internal, solely administrative power in the president's hands with which to make internal changes inside the executive branch of government so as better to give effect to the laws handed to the executive by the Congress. Internationally, from this point onwards, why would the government of any other nation enter into and or abide by any treaty with the United States if the President of the United States holds in his personal hands an independent power to void that treaty by his choice? If it's not binding upon the United States, why would any nation want to bind themselves to acts or omissions that the United States isn't bound to? Now, in August, Iraqi insurgents proved themselves more capable of inflicting casualties on American troops than ever before. 66 American soldiers were killed and more than 1,100 wounded, according to information released by the Defense Department. Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, has proudly claimed on Tuesday, September the 9th, that U.S. forces had, last month, killed between 1,500 and 2,500 Iraqi insurgents. He did not note the ominous fact that for the first time, more Americans were killed by Shia fighters than by Sunni guerrillas. So the United States now faces a war in Iraq on two fronts, the Sunnis in the north and the Shia in the south. All right, let's take a look at Japan and China. Before we get into Japan and China, let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Tonight's report is The Privateer, the mid-September issue, number 510. The price is $180 a year. No, I don't sell it, so don't send any money to me and order The Privateer here. The Law Hour is an editorial function, or has an editorial function, and I am reviewing a private newsletter published by William A.M. Buckler. Now, I highly recommend The Privateer to all of my students. The Privateer is published in Noosa Heads, Queensland, Australia. Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, Australia, and the zip code is 4567. They also have a webpage. It's www.the-privateer.com. Again, that's www.the-privateer.com. The email address is capt@the-privateer.com, all lowercase. Price is $180 a year Australian. I think that's about $130 a year in U.S. funds. It's a dynamite newsletter. I recommend it along with a Money Changer published in Tennessee. From time to time, I do a review on articles that I see or that have merit to our listening audience here from both The Privateer and The Money Changer. Well, it could not be otherwise given the fact that U.S. retail sales fell by 0.3% in August. So looking at Japan and China, the brakes are on all over Asia. The economic slowdown in the United States is now being felt around the world. It's an old adage that says when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world gets pneumonia. Now here's the signal. The data for Japan's core private sector machinery orders, which is a key gauge of trends in all capital spending, fell 11.3% in July from the previous month. The forecast was for a 2.5% drop. They were expecting a small drop, but nothing on the order of 11%. Now this is a two-way signal. You see, for the last 4 or 5 years, Japan has been exporting an accelerating torrent of capital goods, especially tools and new manufacturing machinery, as fast as they could to the fast industrializing China, on top of supplying its own industries with capital tools. Now, the fact that this spending on new capital tools and machinery has fallen 11.3% is a decisive signal that the Asian upswing in new capital investment has put on the brakes full on. And China's economic dragon is now puffing hard. China's exports rose 36% to about $360 billion in the first 8 months of 2004. That's a phenomenal gain, according to International Business Daily, a commercial ministry publication. Now, imports increased into China 41%. To about $361.5 billion. This resulted in an actual trade deficit in China of about $1 billion. Now, the newspaper reported, citing Customs Bureau figures. Now, total trade surged 38% to about $722 billion in the first 8 months. One thing which must always be kept in mind when examining the Chinese economy is that its actual size is only $1.4 trillion. Now, that's their annual gross domestic product, $1.4 trillion. As measured by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Now, the other central economic item to always keep in mind is that China has, to an extent rarely seen in economic history, they have geared their economy toward exports. The Chinese have spent 46% of their GDP on their export industry. That figure dwarfs the similar huge export-driven bubble that crushed the Japanese economy at the end of the 1980s. In blunt economic terms, China stands today with two economies of nearly equal size. One dedicated solely to exports to the tune of that 46% of GDP, and the other geared to China's own internal economy, geared to the scale of the remaining 54%. What this shows us is that China has bet its own economic future on ongoing exports worldwide, but mainly to the enormous U.S. consumer market, and has shown in this and past issues. That also amounts to making a huge economic bet that the U.S. credit expansion will go on and on and on and on, even as U.S. internal and external debts climb higher and higher and higher. Now, if the current massive U.S. internal credit expansion falters, and I guess I could say, when the current massive U.S. internal credit expansion falters, China is going to feel the effect upon its own export industries very quickly. Were the U.S. credit expansion to stop dead in its tracks, China could find itself in a position where half or more of its export machinery parks stand idle, with what's left is working at half speed, still supplying goods to Europe and many other smaller nations. But when they use or lose the U.S. export market, it's curtains for their economy. And what this spells when these events transpire is called depression, world economic depression. Depression translates to a massive shift of ownership of property. Your house will be foreclosed on, and there will be a shift in the ownership of that property to somebody else. That's what it boils down to. Stand by. We'll be right back. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Tonight's report, America's Debt Imbalance, right after this. 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers, quote, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have." That's cited in Deuteronomy 25, 13 through 16. Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that scriptural principle when they put into our federal constitution at Article 1, Section 10. These words. They say, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. And they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we are the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons that I teach in my business school. And we conduct that business school here at the law school several times a year. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you can't come to school, we'll take the school to you. And if you're online, you can go to my website, that's georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing The Privateer, the September number 510 issue of The Privateer, and you can get a copy of that by going to the webpage, www.the-privateer.com, or you can go to their email address, capt@the-privateer.com. I just point that out. They've got a hyphen between the and privateer. It's all lowercase. It's www.the-privateer.com. So the brakes are on all over Asia. The American economy is faltering. We have a massive debt that we can just barely service. And when we get to the point that we start defaulting, like the Argentines did 2 years ago, we will go into default. Now, so far, we're paying all of our bills. That is, the United States of America is making its commitments. But we're in debt up over our eyeballs. In fact, Americans, when you compute all of our debts, public and private, then the commitments that we have, for instance, into the future, we have commitments to Social Security, commitments to veterans who come back from the wars and so on, that total $149 trillion. $149 trillion. If you took all of the assets of our federal government and auctioned them off in the morning at full retail value, which you never get, of course, when you auction something off, but assuming you could get full retail value, there would be a deficit of $7 trillion. Boys and girls, can you say bankruptcy? The United States of America is bankrupt at the federal level, and the individual citizens, the surety underwriters of this massive debt, are also bankrupt, in debt up over their eyebrows. Now, there's a way out of the program, and that is you've got to be free and clear. And you can become free and clear in short order. It doesn't take very long, 6 months, a year, and you can get up to zero COD. That's when you get to a place in life when you can actually start to make money. People who are in debt can never make any money. They're busily making money for their masters because the debtor is servant to the lender. Americans have become servants, and that's because Americans have gone into debt. Debt was the antithesis of the American way of life when I was a child. Americans have now been brainwashed, or mind controlled, however you want to word it. We have been sold on the concepts of debt. Debt is good. Debt is wonderful. Debt is the way to go. Debt is what we want. That's what we've bought. And now we're just about to reap the rewards that come from debts. Now remember, boys and girls, that gold is the currency of kings. Silver is the currency of gentlemen. Barter is the currency of peasants. Debt is the currency of slaves. And that's why the debtor is servant to the lender. Now, there are warning bells everywhere. The U.S. Commerce Department has just reported that wholesale inventories increased 1.3% in August, compared with 1.1% in June. That's well ahead of the analysts' forecasts of 0.7% gain. Now, when inventories are climbing and retail sales are slowing, as is now the case inside the U.S. economy, it is a clear case of the economic warning bells ringing loud and clear. With their climbing inventories, American manufacturers are marching themselves ever closer to an inventory selling contest at distressed prices, head-to-head with all of these foreign exporters who are exporting their goods into the U.S. consumer market. Now, that's going to happen unless delegations of American manufacturers suddenly march in a phalanx towards Washington, screaming at the top of their lungs that they need protection. Protection. That's the opposite of free trade. Or there will be massive job losses right across the U.S. labor force. Now, there are not many more frightening situations to any politicians trying to retain his office. Nothing frightens a politician more than job losses, because people who lose their jobs do vote, don't they? Now let's take a look at inside the European Union. Turkey has made application to join Europe. There's a historical problem with Turkey joining the European Union. There's a problem when you try to merge religious ideologies such as Christianity and Muslim theology in Lebanon, or when you try to cross the race barrier by bringing blacks and whites into close contact. We call that integration. We don't find race problems in Sweden, but we do find race problems in Israel, where we've tried to merge or meld the Muslim Palestinians with the Jewish Israelis. And what do you have? Take a look in England, where you have brought in people from all over the Commonwealth and tried to merge them into your white Anglo-Saxon society in England, you Britishers. And here in the United States, where we have created the melting pot of the world, all of the nations of the world are welcome here. And now we have 68% white and 32% all others. We're headed toward 50-50 by the year 2050. 50-50. 50% white and 50% all others. Now, let's talk about putting Turkey into the European Union. Has anybody ever taken a look at the history of Turkey and Europe? Well, the good people at the Privateer did. And this is a story worth telling. You see, the European Commission, that is the European Union, called the EU Executive, will announce on October the 6th whether it believes Turkey has met the conditions needed to start accession talks to join the European Union. The European leaders will consider Turkey's application at a summit on December the 17th and 18th and decide whether to fix a date for the process to begin. Now, this is nearly an impossible task. Not only does the weight of history lean against Turkey joining Europe, so does religion, as well as just plain hard politics. So let's take a look at a mutual history. Historically, the European encounter with the advancing Muslims really began when a Muslim raiding force crossed the Straits of Gibraltar in the year 711 AD and then advanced all the way into France. Their advance was stopped by one of history's most decisive battles fought in 732 AD, close to the French city of Tours, where the French war chief Martel defeated the Muslim advance and forced their retreat. Later, the Muslims were forced back into Spain, and it took the Spaniards until 1492 to fully reconquer Spain. In sum, then, there is a history of almost 800 years of war between Muslims and Europeans in Western Europe. Now, in the case of Eastern Europe, many times Muslim forces had advanced all the way to the walls of Constantinople. Now, Constantinople, which is called Istanbul today, finally fell to the Muslims in 1453, after which they advanced into the Balkans and then advanced so far north that they actually besieged Vienna, Austria, for the first time in 1529. That's before they were pushed back. Now, the Balkans, like the Spanish Peninsula earlier, became a cockpit of merciless wars. The Muslims later made another full-scale attack and advanced to Vienna in 1683 before they were once again repelled and pushed back. It took until the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1918 to push the Muslims out of Eastern Europe. 1918. The historical sum of all of this history is that European historical sentiment is against joining with Turkey. Religion, too, is a factor. As all of Europe knows in its bones, the religious wars that covered land after land all over Europe during the Reformation and the Catholic Counter-Reformation exceeded in their savagery any of the other wars that have covered the bloody soils of Europe from that day to this. These were wars against supposed fellow Christians. But these religious wars ended at the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, at the end of the 30-year war. Today, all of Europe has Muslim populations living right in amongst them. Few, if any, Europeans see them as any threat. But were another 70-odd million Muslims from Turkey to join the EU, it would change the fundamental nature of Europe as it has been, more or less, ever since the golden days of Aristotle and Socrates in Athens. Such a change would also be irreversible. Politically, Turkey joining the EU would alter the fundamental political balance of Europe. With 70 million people expected to reach 90 million by 2020, Turkey would be the most populous nation in Europe with political power to match, based upon the yet-to-be-ratified new European constitution. Now, in looking at Turkey from 1918, all of the preceding is historical fact and is neither meant nor intended to decry or define the modern Turkey of today. Ever since Ataturk abolished the caliphate in 1924 and eliminated Islamic courts, Turkey has been a secular state with a republican form of government. But as the Muslims to this day remember the Crusades in the Middle East, so does all of Southern Europe remember that they had to defend themselves all the way from Spain to Italy to Greece over the centuries of Muslim fury on lands that they regarded as their own. There is simply too much deeply felt and remembered bloody and sad, tragic and bitter history to be overcome. And in a mutual and peaceful future for both sides, the best that can currently be hoped for is a special associate membership to the European Union for Turkey, but without any real Turkish political influence inside the highest political councils of Europe. Now, perhaps in the future, and after the many present-day Muslim nations have had their reformations and counter-reformations and divorced religion from their politics, a fuller arrangement might be possible. Now, in looking at the Global Market Report, the International Monetary Fund does a Time magazine. That's the headline here on page 10. It is a time-honored and almost legendary truism of financial analysis that the ultimate kiss of death to any bull market is a cover story, lauding that same bull market appearing in Time magazine. What is perhaps less well known, but even more significant, is that when the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, comes out in public lauding the financial soundness of a nation or a group of nations, a financial debacle in that same nation or group of nations is usually right around the corner. Now, with this in mind, and given the mountain of financial imbalances already analyzed in this issue, we give you the IMF's Global Stability Report as reported in The Guardian on September the 16th. Now, according to The Guardian, the gist of the report is that the global financial system is now shockproof. Why, that's almost as good as the Titanic being unsinkable, isn't it? So let's quote the IMF. It says, while it is obviously feasible that one or another financial institution, such as a hedge fund or even a bank, might succumb to serious mistakes in risk management or to outright fraud, such incidents should be isolated cases with limited, if any, contagion to the system as a whole, unquote. Now, any report like this immediately starts the alarm bells jangling within the minds of the captain and officers here on the quarterdeck of the privateer. You know, we've heard this baloney before. And way back in the late 1970s, a few months before the Latin American debt crisis hit, the headlines said that the IMF was crowing about the revival of the region's economies brought about by the recycling of petrodollars from the Saudis through the New York banks to such paradigms of fiscal virtue, such as Brazil and Argentina. Now, moving forward another decade to the end of the 1980s, the IMF was agog at the limitless potential of the rampaging Japanese economy. Of course, the Japanese bubble burst with a deafening roar at the start of the 1990s, and the rest, right up to the present day, is history. Again, that's just more IMF poppycock. Now, moving forward again to March-April 1997, 3 months before the Asian crisis hit with the crash dive of the Thailand currency, called the Baht, B-A-H-T, both the IMF and Moody's, the debt rating agency, had large presences in Thailand. Moody's was there to downgrade huge quantities of Thai debt paper. The IMF was there to reassure the world that the Thai economy was basically sound. The Baht, the Thai dollar, or the Thai unit of currency, crashed in May 1997 with short-term interest rates in Thailand that spiraled up to 250% per year. The contagion had spread to Southeast Asia by July of 1997 and had reached South Korea and Japan itself by November of 1997. So before we get to the significance of this latest IMF pronouncement, let's consider two more facts. First, the Asian crisis was the last time that the IMF has actively bailed out the government's central banks involved in any national or regional financial crisis. The IMF did not act to bail out Argentina or Brazil when they stopped servicing their foreign debt in 2002 and 2003. And second, the IMF report quoted above is a global stability report. It refers not to the financial systems of a single nation or group of nations. It refers to the global financial system as a whole. Well, the epicenter, the foundation of this global system is, of course, the United States. Now, recall for a moment that throughout the tenure of the Bush administration, as budgets went back into official deficit and trade and current account deficits have exploded, the IMF has periodically come out with muted and not so muted warnings about the threat to global stability posed by these U.S. imbalances. Well, then, why is it now that these warnings about the threat to global stability, when it is more obvious today than it was then, that the domestic U.S. fiscal and financial imbalances are growing ever larger and greatly worsened by the imperial overreach of the U.S. and its Iraqi occupation, the IMF now decides that the global system is shock-proof? I say that's doublespeak. Far be it for the IMF to refute Mr. Greenspan of our venerable U.S. Federal Reserve or Mr. Snow of our U.S. Treasury, who have been playing this broken record now for years. Farther still, be it for the IMF to introduce any semblance of doubt into the minds of Americans who are being reassured daily by both political candidates and both parties that the American economy is fundamentally sound and the only choice before the American electorate at the ballot box on November the 2nd is which candidate will better protect their physical safety and prolong their economic well-being. Did you hear that? You don't have a real choice to make here, boys and girls. Everything's running along very smooth, very stable. Just listen to Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw. Now, maybe the public doesn't want to hear it, and maybe the politicians think that the American public can't understand the truth or hear the truth or bear the truth. This quote is from Lawrence Kotlikoff. He's the economics chairman at Boston University. The context of these remarks is the gigantic fiscal gap which will open up as the baby boomer generation begins to collect their Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security benefits. Mr. Kotlikoff estimates this gap to be $51 trillion. The estimate from the Brookings Institution is $60 trillion. The International Monetary Fund's own estimate is a bit more optimistic. It comes in at $47 trillion. Now, this particular fiscal gap, not to mention the entirety and the entirely separate U.S. budget deficits, and then the trade and current account deficits And then all of the other unfunded liabilities are playing no part whatsoever in the present political campaign. They're being mentioned by neither Bush nor Kerry. They're totally ignored. We Americans have $149 trillion of total debt, and we're going to pile on that another $47 to $60 trillion more when the baby boomers retire over the next 20 years. The only word that fits the economic circumstances that we face today is insanity. It's the only word that I can think of to describe where we are. We Americans have become totally insane. Now, Bush and Kerry are promising to cut in half the current budget deficit over the next 4 years. Both candidates are at the same time promising more tax cuts, and they're both promising more government spending, all at the same time. Mr. Kerry has a new health plan. Mr. Bush is promising to speed the spread of freedom throughout the world. Both candidates have, of course, promised not to cut Social Security or Medicare benefits. And there is no hint from either of these contending political parties of the real fiscal, financial, and economic issues facing the United States and therefore the entire world. By the nature of the platforms, even though these presidential candidates are not bound by these platforms that are served up by the political parties, but any hint of the real issues would quickly illustrate the stark fact that neither candidate has any plan, any desire, or any intention to confront any of the real problems that confront us economically. And that's because these economic problems are insoluble. Well, there is a solution. It's called collapse. It's called depression. It's not very pleasant, and it's not something that we want to look forward to, but it's the inevitable result. It's kind of like the inevitable result of cancer is death. Is there a solution to cancer? Yes. Yes. It's called death. Is there a solution to the world's impending economic crisis? Yes. It's economic death, which means that you go into default and you lose all your toys. So let me again remind you that to save your toys, you need to do something for yourself. If you think that your government is going to do something to save your toys, I think you're whistling Dixie through a straw hat. You've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in both the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Hey, there's the signal. Says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.